Hello, and welcome to another edition of Critical Q&A, the show where I answer your questions based on what you've left for me in the comments section of my Q&A videos, or questions you've sent to me by email at askchrisshelton@gmail.com. Today, the day you're seeing this, Sunday, is my birthday, so you can all wish me happy birthday. we are rolling into the Christmas season, and I just wanted to put out a little reminder that I do have a critical merchandise site, and I would really love it if you guys would visit it and check out some of my merch and or merchandise, and you know, maybe see about getting it for yourself or your significant others or whoever. Also, I wanted to remind everybody, because I haven't said anything about this in a while, that I do have a Patreon campaign. It is a page, it is Patreon, it is a site where you can support me and this show and my channel. And it is you guys who actually allow this to keep happening, just so you know. So I really, really appreciate all of your support. I do have a lot of great supporters out there. And thank you very much, very, very much for your love. And if any of you are enjoying what I'm doing, and you want to see more of it, and you want to see me continue doing this, then consider contributing to my welfare on the Patreon site. All right, so now let's get on with some questions, because we have a few this week, and I think there's some pretty good ones. Jen Danny, I have always viewed high school's most important job as teaching critical thinking skills, but I feel that they have been farther and farther from that as they concentrate on teaching to take a test successfully. What are your feelings on this, and do you think that it is or should be part of public school's mandate to teach such skills? Well, I know that my own education from my public schooling, I didn't do any private school, I did public school all the way through, and I don't recall particularly learning critical thinking skills as such. In fact, as I've said, I didn't even realize critical thinking was a thing until I got out of Scientology. I am aware that there has been a lot of changes in the educational system since I was in school. I mean, I graduated high school back in 1987. So I know there's things like Common Core, and there have been adjustments and whatnot. I think that there has been, from what I know, you know, education has been an evolving process every generation for years and years and years. I mean, going all the way back to the 20s and 30s, there were massive changes made in the educational system back then. I'm only going to speak in broad terms about this rather than saying, you know, putting, you know, any endorsement behind Common Core or saying it's bad or saying it's good. I don't know enough about it to say a whole lot about that. But I do know that in general terms, I very much would like to see critical thinking skills being taught. And by that, I mean really the basics of logic and rhetoric and reason. And critical thinking skills that include talking about what is an idea, what is an argument, not an argument like two people fighting, but an argument like a logical argument. And how do you present one, and how do you think your way through doing that? I think one of the only things that I've seen in my experience with high school or with schooling in general that addressed that kind of thinking was like debate club. Or, you know, that kind of, maybe some speech classes or some, you know, some work in English class in terms of analyzing literature, looking for, you know, in a way, looking for symbolism and looking for the meaning of things, really having to drill down into details on that. And maybe, you know, some math skills in a way in terms of learning certain fundamental rules of how math, not just what is, you know, the operations of math, but why is math that way? How does it really work? They got into that a little bit in high school, and I think that contributes to a rational, you know, sequential way of thinking. But really, critical thinking and logic and cognitive skill thinking and psychology and the tools of critical thinking that I talk about on this channel are not taught now, as far as I know, until college level, and that's, you know, purely elective. And I did a podcast recently with Kevin Delaplante, I don't know, a couple months ago, where we discussed this, the fact that it really is a multidisciplinary subject. So I think it would take an entire lead up you know, in curriculum to over years to really teach a well-rounded look at critical thinking, how to think, not what to think, right? Because it takes a build-up to it. You don't just jump right into college-level classes and go, oh, well, we should really be doing that in sixth grade. No, what you should be doing is sixth grade. You know, you gotta teach sixth grade skills to sixth graders, and that might be an intro or beginning part of critical thinking skills with, you know, with basics of logic and stuff like that. So yeah, I really, really think that that should be part of our schooling. I've been told by teachers who are teaching, right, not administrators or bureaucrats, I've been told by teachers that that Common Core is about critical thinking, and that it is about thinking through the problem and teaching methodology of thinking more so than teaching rote patterns of how to problem solve math or, you know, science or whatever. And if that's true, I would support that sort of thing, right? That's what I've been told about it. So, you know, you guys let me know in the comments section what you know about this. And because there's all kinds of social media memes and nonsense flying around about Common Core and about education. And it's a very controversial subject. I realize that. And there's a lot of very strong opinions about it. To answer, you know, another part of your question, I don't think we should be teaching for the test. I think we should be teaching for life skills and for, you know, how is a person going to best get along in life? And that's really, I think, part of the struggle of trying to figure out what should education consist of, because a lot of people have a lot of different ideas about it. And there are a lot of different backgrounds, different cultures, different ideas that people bring to it because of their experiences and culture and backgrounds. So how do you, you know, figure out something that is going to be all inclusive for everyone in a country of, you know, like the United States, where you have like, you know, hundreds of millions of people? It's a rough question, right? And then is the model that we have now of, you know, 30, 40 kids in a classroom, one teacher, is that really the best way to go about doing it? I mean, there's, you know, you're getting that whole education problem, and it is a problem, and it's a big, big, big one. So I'm going to just, I open that can of worms now, but let me put the can back on it, the lid back on that can, because let me just tiptoe back over to critical thinking. And I don't know if we don't get this being taught in schools to our children so that they are able to think, then we are going to have really, really, really big problems with our society in kind of the next couple of generations. Because the world is changing, and the amount of information that is available to us to think with is so much that we are overwhelmed by it. And that is a new thing because of the internet and because of the proliferation of information. So we need to adapt to this. This isn't the same as 1950 or 1900 or 1850. It's a different world that we're living in. And we need to change with it, and our education needs to change with it. And that's why I say that it's very, very important that we get up to speed on this as quickly as possible. Penny Mixow, recently we were rewatching your What is Wrong with Scientology series. In, I believe, the first one, you state that your focus and disagreement is with the abusive practices of the Church of Scientology and not with the dogma or technology. I'm wondering now, a few years later, if your viewpoint on that has changed. As I understand it from a lot of things I've read, the technology is the primary instrument of indoctrination, which creates the mental state where mind control is possible. One example, boring, repetitive tasks such as word clearing a passage over and over again because one disagrees with the content can create enough mental discomfort that one will accept a disagreeable dogmatic statement in order to end the boredom. This is a great question, Penny, because the truth is that over time my views on this have changed. And it's been interesting looking back at some of my videos from time to time and seeing, you know, a bit of an evolution as I've gone through this recovery process and learning and education process over the last couple of years. peeling off what we call the onion layers. You know, if you look at the Scientology belief system or any destructive cult system as a layer of onions skin, you know, and you get out of that situation and one layer peels off and then there's a whole nother layer and then you're peeling that and then another one and another one. And to this day, that is still happening with me all the time. So in terms of the technology of Scientology or its dogma, so to speak, I do have a lot of problems with it. And I've come to learn that there are a lot of things wrong with it. I think one thing that has not changed in all this time is that I still feel very strongly that people should be able to believe whatever they want. You know, in terms of what's in their own head. You know, you want to believe the sky is red or whatever, great. You know, now if you're going to tell me that because you don't believe in, you know, wearing shoes, that I shouldn't wear shoes either, that's where we start having a problem. But as far as you know, hey, great, cheers. If you're not hurting anybody, I don't care. And the same applies for Scientology dogma or belief, right? Somebody wants to believe that, you know, for them, that clearing words and making little demos out of clay and stuff is all they need in order to learn something. Okay, you know, I'm not on some mission to change everybody's mind about that. So I'm not into, you know, attacking belief as such. Now, that being said, there are methods and methodologies and things, procedures that occur in Scientology, and there are core beliefs of Scientology that are presented as though they are universal truths, as though they are always true in every case without exception, or they are practically absolutes. And that's just not true, right? And when you make a statement like that, where you don't allow for any exceptions or for any, you know, other ideas to be there, that is where you can get, you know, into some fanatical thinking. So I am going to be doing a series of videos this next year on the critiquing the basic technology of Scientology. And that'll come following my video series on deconstructing the book Scientology by James R. Lewis, which I'm sure a lot of you guys have seen. I'm going to finish that project. I'm going to finish that series. And then I'm going to get into this other series. At least that's what I have planned right now. And I think it's going to be a little bit of a series. It'll be like the Deconstructing Scientology series. I'll be taking Scientology, you know, bits and pieces, a video at a time, and breaking them down and looking at where they do work and where they don't work and why, and that sort of thing. And I think that'll be kind of interesting. So, you know, if that sounds at all interesting to you guys, let me know, you know, in the comments. If that sounds horrible and like a totally horrible idea, then also let me know, because I don't want to waste a lot of time on that either if that's not something you guys, you know, don't want to see. But anyway, that is how I will be tackling Scientology dogma, I know it's technology, in the very near future, because I do have a lot of disagreements with some of that technology. Fuzzy Skinner, do you know what most loyal Scientologists might think about transgender people? I know that Hubbard held a very dim view of homosexuality, but gender dysphoria and related issues were not nearly as widely known in the 1950s, when Dianetics and Scientology's doctrinal prejudices were being established, as they are today. I wonder if LRH was even aware of the existence of trans people. If so, is there an established Scientology position on them? Or would they just be put in the same category as gay, lesbian people, covert hostility, and subjected to the same hypocrisy and abuse? The views from the Scientology world about any kind of sexual deviancy, anything that's not straight, you know, Christian minded, conservative, and by Christian I mean like old school Christian. I mean, I'm talking like 1950s, Leave It to Beaver kind of attitude, right? Very conservative, staunch ideas about sex and sexuality are frowned upon. Anything that's not that is not really what Scientology is about. when it comes to, people not being who they were born as, oh, without question, that is unacceptable. That goes beyond the bounds. And I'm not sure, I didn't review my earlier videos on this, so I'm not sure how much I went into this, but I'm gonna throw something out here that that I might have said before, I'm not really sure. But here's the view on it, right? It's not just that Scientologists think that such an individual who's gay, lesbian, LGBTQ of any kind is 1-1. They do think that. They think they're 1-1. They're a covert hostility as an emotional tone level, right? They also think that such people are what's called out of valence. And a valence in Scientology is a personality, is your personality package. It's who you are. So you can adopt or, take in other people's personalities is one of the theories of Scientology, and take on their, it's called taking on somebody else's valence, right? Whether it's your mother, your father, your uncle, your teacher, your priest, whoever, right? Anybody, including somebody of the opposite sex, okay? So there's this idea in Scientology that a man has a man body, right? Born with a man body. There's no man or woman thetans or spirits. But when you're born as a man, that's the role that you have, right? And so you're supposed to have this valence of, I am a man. So if that person in a man body starts acting in like a woman, right, with woman characteristics, or thinks he is a woman or has woman characteristics, then in Scientology's assessment of that person, it would be that he's out of valence. He's being something that he is not. And it's kind of interesting, actually, as I'm sitting here talking about this right now, I'm really seeing the illogic of this within the Scientology world. But this is what they would say. And they don't see this as illogical. If you're born in Scientology with a man body, you're a man. And if you're born with a woman body, you're a woman. And that's it. It's very black and white. So if you're out of valence, there are specific things, specific procedures and processes that are done in Scientology to address that out of valenceness, and to get the person to get rid of that other personality that they're holding on to or have adopted as their own and release it and become themselves, right? And of course, the illogic of this, I mean, it's so funny that I never really thought of this through all the way when I was in Scientology. But, it goes back to what I just said. If a spiritual being, a thetan, there is no man and woman, concept there. It's just a spiritual being. So why would there be so much attention on this man-woman thing? Because in Scientology, it's stressed that you're not a body. You're not your body. And yet Hubbard put a whole little system in place to heavily enforce that you be what your body is. Anyway, it's kind of interesting, huh? So that would be a whole different, that whole valence thing would be another way that Scientology would try to deal with somebody who was, who was a man who wanted to be a woman or thought he was born as a woman or thought he needed to be a woman, or other way around, a woman who was like, very masculine and wanted to be a man, right? Or dress up as a man, act like a man, talk like a man, etc. That whole transgender thing would be considered this gross, blatant out of valenceness. And the other way that would be addressed also, I'm pretty sure I haven't talked about this before. So the other way that this would be addressed is through pulling overts and withholds, sex checking. Right? Scientology's confessional procedure, the way they get people to tell them that, transgressions they've committed. Because they believe in Scientology that if you have, besides the personality stuff, another reason you would take on the valence of somebody else or something else is because you have committed overts, transgressions, harmful acts against that thing in the past. So if you're, gay or homosexual or, LGBTQ, it must be, and you're a man, it must be because you've committed all these, wrongdoings, these overts against women. And now you feel like you have to be a woman in order to further the survival of women that you've hurt in the past So now you're going to take on that role in order to ensure that that role, you know, that position that you committed all those harmful acts against continues to survive, if that kind of makes sense. So they're going to pull a bunch of, you know, overts and evil purposes and things like that from you. And all of this processing costs mega money, right? So so they have, you know, lots of excuses with LGBTQ people to just audit and audit and audit and audit them. And they will, and they'll do that too, right? Because as far as I understand it right now, Scientology will very definitely accept LGBT people into it if those people, you know, want to change, right? Want to recognize that there's something wrong with what they're doing and want to change that condition, right? They're not into practicing homosexuality, right? Or any deviancy of any kind. I think I made that clear. So anyway, hope that answers that question. Chris Wood. Greetings, Mr. Shelton. In a variety of your videos, you reference and or describe a host of orgs, each replete with its own management. In my own layman's understanding of any type of organizational management, especially in a for-profit environment, it's not only important but necessary to recruit and to promote people with the proper skill sets and experience to run an organization. From watching your videos, it seems to me that practically nobody at any level in Scientology has any idea as to how to run anything, let alone managing others and running a quasi-business type endeavor. It just seems like they, Scientologists, just pick any old Tom, Dick, or Harry and give them a management position. I'm curious as to the qualifications Scientology requires for its various levels of management. Could you explain this, please? Yeah. First off, in terms of structure, if you guys haven't seen it, I did lay out the structure of Scientology management in a whole other video. It's a very long one. And I put diagrams and things in it, right? So you can see how Scientology is laid out in its hierarchy of levels of organizations and how that management structure works. So that's something you need to watch separately. I'm not going to explain all that again. But here's the attitude in Scientology, and this goes all the way back to the beginning of the Sea Organization in 1967. And this attitude goes throughout Scientology, and it is that you have lived millions and millions of lives in the past. Therefore, you already know how to do anything we're going to ask you to do. And this is especially true in the Sea Organization. This isn't quite as hardcore at the staff level or at the public level, but with the Sea Org, this is all it is. And Sea Org are the management structure of Scientology. So you have your local churches, and then you have, you know, the management groups that exist at different levels above that, continental level, international level. That's all Sea Org. So the management attitude, the entire attitude of Scientology, of the Sea Org, is make it go right. Right? This is Hubbard, what Hubbard referred to as the supreme test, right? Is a being's ability to make things go right. In other words, just get the job done, and I don't want to hear any excuses why you can't do it. And this attitude, you know, very much pervades the Sea Organization. So when you are given a post or a position, it's just start, just do it. Go. Bam, bam, bam. Let's make things happen, right? And then you're given, as you go, on the job training and you go into the course room during your study time when you can get it, and you study Hubbard policies and issues and references describing various policies and procedures for your job so that you can get it better, right? But you not being trained for your job is no excuse to not do your job. Okay, so this is one of the reasons why Scientology is so bloody inefficient and makes so many mistakes and is not, you know, an expanding, thriving, growing organization. In addition to the fact that the leader, the guy at the top, is you know, completely nuts and is, you know, extremely authoritarian and dictatorial. In addition to all of that, there is this problem with all of the management not really totally understanding their jobs. And this was, you know, when I worked at Continental Management, this was a problem because we knew we didn't know how to run an org, you know, and yet here we were running the orgs. And very, very few people who are in management have been promoted up from a position where they were running an org. There are some, but not a lot, right? And there were times when some of these organizations were failing and they had to have their executives removed, and somebody from the C organization, from the management level, had to be sent down on a temporary basis to run the show, right? To take over as the executive running the organization. They would send in, you know, maybe a small team of three or four people to run the organization, sometimes only one or two. Those people didn't hardly ever know what they were doing, and they didn't really do much better of a job than the people who were there before, who didn't know what they were doing, right? So this just kind of, this whole thing just kind of goes, you know, in this sort of vicious circle, in this cycle of somebody gets put onto a post or a position, they do the best they can, they try to get trained for it as fast as they can, they try to like work out what to do and how to do it, and then eventually, either sooner or later, they fail, they bomb. And then they get, you know, slapped around, they get taken off that post, and somebody else gets put there. And it's this sort of revolving door sort of situation. Very, very, very few Scientology and Sea Org executives have lasted in their posts or on their senior executive positions for very long. I think I know of less than 10 internationally who have held their position or their post for longer than 10 years, right? It's like that. And of course, after 10 years, you kind of know what you're doing. You've sort of figured it out. But, you know, a lot of guys, they last months, a couple, you know, a year or two, and they just, blah, they just can't take it. I mean, I was in management for, 8 years. It took me, I don't know, about 3 to actually figure out what the hell I was doing in running all of the technical divisions of the Western United States organizations, which was my job, right, as management. Overseeing all the courses and the auditing and everything. That took a long time for me to figure out. And when I first showed up there, I was swimming, totally swimming. Didn't have any idea what I was doing. But that's the Sea Org attitude, right? And it is a double-edged sword in terms of what it does to you. I mean, it raises your competency. It raises your necessity to do good and do things right and figure stuff out because you're just thrown on, man, and you better make it work. So you have, you know, suddenly you are like figuring things out that you never imagined you could figure out. But on the other hand, you know, while that's kind of good in the long run, if it helps you, you know, and you rise to the occasion, on the other hand, you know, there's this whole cyclic problem of people who don't make it, don't rise to the occasion, can't figure things out, and, you know, they just get removed. And this all goes back to L. Ron Hubbard. This is not David Miscavige. This is L. Ron Hubbard. This is how he set things up all the way back to 1967 when he was running things with the Sea Org. And they were sailing around in the Mediterranean and along, you know, the English coast and the European coast with people who were on these boats who did not have any sailor training, any idea what they were doing, and they made a total botch mess of it over and over and over again. When you read the accounts of what life was like for these guys, oh my God, it's amazing they lived. I mean, because the sea is dangerous. And Hubbard was just, you know, you're the chief engineer now. And it was like, okay, and off the guy would go. And he didn't know anything about engineering, you know. And I mean, we're talking about kids too. I mean, 15, 16, 17-year-old Sea Org members at the time, you know, who were, you know, considered executives on these ships, you know, and engineers and whatnot. So it's kind of miraculous that people are able to rise to the occasion as much as they are when put in positions like that. But it's also, you know, you see the results with Scientology internationally. You know, it's a mess. And it's a mess because Hubbard's attitude about the whole thing was totally wrong. So there you go. I think that means it's time for flash answers. Barbara Ann, I wonder if L. Ron Hubbard ever laughed himself to sleep at night thinking, I just wonder how much more crazy bull stuffing I can get people to believe and pay for. Actually, he didn't really have that attitude. Hubbard really did believe in what he was doing. Now, I temper that with, you know, in the early days, he, you know, was aware of the con and stuff too. But Scientology is an example of a situation where the guy who was the con artist became the con-y, you know, he believed his own stuff. And there was always a thread of that through Dianetics and Scientology. It's not a black and white issue in Scientology of Hubbard knowingly conning people all those years. And I talk about this a lot in my book, so it's a nuanced thing. So just as a flash answer, I'm just going to say, yeah, that wasn't really how he was. Jonathan Mark, Scientologists often speak of blowing charge. What is the difference between charge and an engram? Are they the same thing? Technically speaking, no, they're not exactly the same thing. Although an engram, which is an incident of pain and unconsciousness that has trauma connected to it, has charge. The charge refers to electrical charge. And briefly, what that means is that Hubbard said that all the mental phenomena that impacts on you actually exists in matter and energy. It has energy connected to it. It's a mass. And it has electrical charge that can be measured. And he pawned off on Scientologists that that's what the E-meter is reading, which is not true at all. So when they say they're blowing charge, it means that that electrical charge that is contained in those pictures of those in the mind is dissipating, is blowing off, and therefore will not have an effect on the person anymore. So engrams are only one kind of charge that a person carries around with them. William Travel. It's well known that Scientologists aren't allowed to look up facts about their church, but are there other information taboos? They must surely have banned The Producers by Mel Brooks, since the parallels with the Ideal Org hoax are so painfully obvious. No, actually, Scientology isn't quite that nuanced in its thinking. It simply has filters on the internet in the same way that North Korea or China do, that, you know, Scientologists can't look at certain things, and they put those filters on the internet, on their internet access. Not the public Scientologists, but the staff, the Sea Org, right? Like, you could go into a Scientology organization and they have places that access the internet, the stations access the internet, but they have these filters on it. So you can't go into a Scientology org and go on one of their computers and look up anything about Xenu, right? That ain't gonna happen. And in the Sea Org, the same thing. Anybody who has internet access in the Sea Org has a computer, if they're allowed to have internet access at all, they have these filters installed on the computer first by security. So that's how much they put security on the internet usage. They will say or prohibit that you read certain books, like, for example, no Scientologist would be allowed to read my book, or John Atack's book, or, you know, Russell Miller's book, or any of that. Or see movies that specifically have anti-Scientology statements in them, that would not be so good. Don't go see that. What they'd say is they'd have a rumor line in Scientology amongst the Scientologists of, oh yeah, don't see that. That's got N theta in it. Oh, okay. You know, that, oh, okay. I don't want to have any of that N theta. So that's how they control that sort of thing. Okay, guys, so that's it for this week's episode. Thanks a lot for coming around and watching. If you have any comments, questions, feedback, whatever, put it in the comment section below. I see it all, whether I answer it or not, and I do make an effort to answer a lot of stuff. So let me know what you're thinking about the show, how we're doing on this, and any questions, like I said, and comments that you have. Thanks a lot, and I'll see you guys next week.